WEFT, viable and on the air.
Just a little after 6 p.m. here on WEFT Champaign 90.1 FM radio. This is where we are at. My name is Ben. Just to let you know that I am live here in the studio. I'll just let you know that the views and opinions expressed on air are solely those of the speaker and do not necessarily represent those of WEFT Champaign, Prairie Air Incorporated, Station Management, the Board of Directors, or the WEFT Associates. I'm just going to do a quick weather update because obviously we've had some pretty severe weather here with cold. It got below, I'm sure y'all were know that it got below zero, and the roads were some parts of the road were not the best to drive on. It was a bit bit difficult if you had to go anywhere yesterday, especially. They're a bit better from what I could tell. It's currently 21 degrees, and temperatures will get about into 17 degrees, but they will go up. Temperatures are expected to go up to the 30s, 35, 36 degrees tomorrow. In fact, and then I think on Wednesday, they'll expect to get up to 40 degrees, 42 degrees on Wednesday. So that's just a little quick weather report. I don't know if there'll be any more precipitation. I think there's likely chance of rain on Thursday, the 18th. So keep a lookout on that. But that's what the current forecast has right now. Just some public service announcements. I do WEFT end of the year donation match. So it's some exciting news. Thanks to a generous WEFT supporter, an Airshifter alumni from the late 1980s, every dollar donated to WEFT's Winter Appeal fundraising campaign now through Christmas will be matched. If you donated $50, it is doubled to $100. You donated $100, it is doubled to $200. So now is the perfect time to make your end of the year donation to WEFT. It will be matched dollar for dollar. And of course, you can donate online at weft.org. Let's see if there's any other Airshifter. I can't really. I don't have any other current announcements. I'll just again remind to our viewers here on where we're at that the views and opinions expressed on air are solely those of the speaker, and not necessarily represent those of WEFT Champaign, Prairie Air Incorporated, Station Management, the Board of Directors, or the WEFT associates. This past week I interviewed Dua Al-Jasuki, who is a member of the Palestinian diaspora and a CU Muslim Action Committee member. She had a piece in the Public Eye, the latest Public Eye, this month's Public Eye, titled Not Every Israeli, but All of Israel, about the situation in Gaza. And we talked, I did an interview to her, talk about that piece, but we also talked about genocide that's also been happening in Sudan. So I'll just I have my interview set and ready to go. So this is my interview with Dua Al-Jasuki.
Dua, or in Arabic it's Dua, so whatever people can pronounce. But I am a local Palestinian, and I've been in the Champaign-Urbana area for, this is our 10th year now here, and so we're, you know, consider ourselves pretty settled in the region. And I am also a member of the CU Muslim Action Committee, or CUMAC for short, which is a community group dedicated to advocating for Palestinian rights and self-determination, as well as other issues relevant to the Muslim community. So we do general advocacy for things related to the Muslim community, which has been very important in the past 2 years with a rise in, anti-Muslim hate and discrimination locally and across the U.S. and globally. And yeah, besides that, I am really excited to be here. So thank you so much for having me on your show.
I know you are Palestinian, and obviously we'll get into what's happening in Palestine and both Gaza and the West Bank, because obviously with what we've been witnessing in the last 2 years, with what many are saying and what I believe is the genocide according to even the International Court of Justice and even some Israeli human rights organizations, but Betzela calling what is happening in Gaza a genocide. We will discuss about that. You wanted to discuss about the situation of what is happening in Sudan.
Yeah, so, you know, obviously with Palestine and the so-called ceasefire, if Americans knew, call it not a ceasefire, and they give us daily news on kind of what's happening. And so we'll get back to kind of the fact that we are currently on day 54, day 55 of not a ceasefire, but 786th day of the actual ongoing genocide. But I wanted to touch on Sudan a little bit, just because it's not talked about enough. And the horrors that are currently being reported out of Sudan, and have been for a while, but especially now, are definitely something that need to be spoken about. There needs to be raised awareness about, and people need to kind of get involved, because the statistics and the numbers and the scenes and the stories are just absolutely horrific. So if you're not familiar with kind of a very quick background into what's currently happening, is that in Sudan, you have almost like three factions. You have the Sudanese civilians, residents, people, citizens that live there. Then you have the SAF, the Sudanese Armed Forces, and you have the RSF. The RSF are called the Rapid Support Forces, and they are a foreign-backed paramilitary that's operating in Sudan. And they're backed primarily by the UAE, the United Arab Emirates, as well as, and the UAE funds them through funds through a lot of Western countries. So in the same way that we're seeing a lot of Western support for the ongoing genocide in Palestine, you see a similar sort of support for what the RSF is doing in Sudan. And recently, why Sudan might have been a little bit more in the news, despite the fact that this has been ongoing for a few years now, is that there was a major city called Infashir, which is on kind of the western side of Sudan, and it was surrounded by RSF forces and eventually fell to these RSF forces. And basically, the slaughter in the city was so horrendous that you could see pools of blood from satellite imagery. And so the thing that stands out to me is that in the past few weeks, the death toll is estimated to be at least 60,000 people. So 60,000 Sudanese people have been murdered and experienced vile violence. So if you read the stories, you know, sexual violence, mutilation, torture, after weeks of starvation because, again, of that blockade and the siege by the RSF. And it's just something that, one, you really need to talk about, because in Gaza, we've been talking about that death toll and we've been witnessing it kind of climb up and climb up and climb up. And I think official toll is probably 70,000, although estimates across multiple studies have it at least 4 to 10 times as much. So some people are saying it's, you know, close to 700,000, but the absolute minimum is probably 200,000 Palestinians have been murdered.
So at least, like, what in terms of, I know we're talking about Gaza, but in terms of, like, because of all the infrastructure that's been destroyed, and it's impossible to tell, like, with all the rubble, that's destruction, it's impossible to tell.
Exactly. It's really hard to tell that death toll for a number of reasons. One, there's a full collapse of the medical structure, infrastructure in Gaza. Two, the Ministry of Health currently is tracking deaths to the best of their ability, but they only track the deaths that actually arrive to a hospital and can be verified. Mm-hmm. And so we know that there are tens of thousands of people still under the rubble. We also know that tens of thousands have been dying due to starvation and their injuries and succumbing to all of these, you know, poor hygiene and all of the circumstances that basically this indiscriminate bombing campaign by Israel, this genocidal indiscriminate bombing campaign by Israel has led to. But I keep thinking of this 60,000 that have been murdered in Sudan over the past few weeks. And I think about how it felt to witness the climb of that number over the past 2 years in Gaza. So even though we know for a fact that, close to a fact, we know that at least 200,000 have been murdered, the number, you know, if you've been tracking this daily like I have, like a lot of people have, you see it climb every single day. And it crossed 60,000, you know, a few months ago. But then to open up the news and to say that we have piles and piles of dead people in Sudan and their bodies are now being counted and that death toll is 60,000. It's just horrifying. And, you know, in Palestine, we kind of talk about, in Gaza especially, we talk about percentage like, you know, 200,000 dead out of 2.4 million is a very, very high percentage. But 60,000 people dying in a few weeks is just unfathomable. And it's, and it, and you know, and you know, to quote like an international committee that said, they said this is our low estimate, the 60,000 in Sudan. There's as many as 150,000 residents of Al-Fashir unaccounted for. So, you know, where are they? Are they living? Are they not? They're not thought to have left the city because of the way the RSF had kind of surrounded that city. And so, you know, it's just really, it's really scary to see. And I think tying this back to what we, when I say we, Western powers, even people of the world, have kind of normalized in terms of what Israel is doing. But in terms of what Israel is doing in Gaza and Gaza and the West Bank and to Palestinians. And then, you know, it's not new, right? This idea of using bombing hospitals, bombing schools, bombing shelters. We've unfortunately seen it happen, you know, with the U.S. in Afghanistan. We've seen it happen with the U.S. in Iraq. But it being so visual and present and in front of our eyes, and like you mentioned, Ben, before we started, like, you know, it's we watch it in 4K
on our phones,
it's live social media, exactly. And we're watching it, and now it's happening in other places, and these other places don't even have to like pretend or hide. We've basically dismantled, and again, I use we here very loosely. I know there are so many of us that are enraged about what's happening in Palestine, equally enraged about what is happening in Sudan and in Congo and other areas. But what the powers, the Western powers particularly, that are supporting Israel have allowed to happen with the normalization of war crimes, completely,
it's become talked about how with the UN, essentially, when it comes to stopping or, Israel has the backing of the United States, and that's really all it needs, because oftentimes what you will see at the UN vote, but when they vote, usually just the United States and Israel, and that's enough for them to essentially continuing Israel's massive killing and bombing. Of course, there's also the West Bank, where annexation, which I know you give a let people know that you had a piece in the public eye titled "Not Every Israeli, But All of Israel" in the late in the latest edition of the public eye. But essentially, it's becoming this allowance of, I would say, international law has it already been totally destroyed, and now it's created this normalization of just crimes against humanity. Violation of killing of civilians, bombing of hospitals, bombing of schools, destruction of infrastructure created. I feel like now, and especially now, Sudan, the Congo, and of course, Gaza and Palestine. And as we kind of mentioned, I feel like it's just been kind of a long had the war, the war in Afghanistan, the war in Iraq, Afghanistan. There was the bombing of a Doctors Without Borders hospital. Not a mountain list of what we would consider war crimes, but of course, nobody in the United States officials were held to account. Of course, there was also someone played a part in destabilization of in Libya. There's Somalia. I mean, you can point to all of these. This was all done, usually done without even approval of Congress. Or little, and usually been this long. This has been something that's happening for a long, long time. And now, what's a little bit different now is that usually everyone can see it now, or is able to. As we mentioned, with Gaza, we're seeing a live stream genocide now. It's on everyone's phones, where everyone can see it if choose to.
Yeah,
Yeah.
exactly. Yeah, like it's just really troubling to see the reports out of Sudan. And to know that we've heard this before, this very thing has happened multiple times. We've seen it so many times in the past 2 years live on our phones. And then you know that it's happening. There is not going to be, at least, at this point, no one's held accountable. There's no one pushing to stop. I mean, I keep a minimum of 60,000 have been murdered in the last few weeks. 150,000 are missing. And so it's just really scary to see where we're at and what militaries and paramilitaries and violence can happen. And it's just our lives still continue, and they still keep going, and it's very troubling,
For Palestinians, I know there is, it's difficult. There's this word, living in the diaspora, and granted, and I know that's obviously very difficult. Whether or not you have, granted, we do have member, I believe we do have members, Palestinian members here who have lost like dozens, if not like. Somebody spoke at, I think it was a Champaign City Council, that they had lost, I want to say, at least over 25 members of their family.
Yeah, we have multiple Palestinian families here who've lost dozens of family members in Gaza. Across five Palestinian families here, they've lost nearly 200 family members. And so, yeah, so definitely thing to say about, like you bring up, like the Palestinian diaspora and being a part of that and thinking back to what's happening in Palestine. And it's something that I think about a lot, actually, because on my father's side, they were from a village outside of Jaffa. And prior to 1947, there were about 100,000 Arab Palestinians that lived in that area. And then after 1947, at the end of the massive violence of the beginning of the Nakba in 1949, there were only about 3,000 Palestinians that still lived in that area. And so my grandfather's family, my grandfather is a Nakba survivor himself, and his family ended up going towards the West Bank. They fled towards the West Bank. But a lot of the people that lived in Jaffa actually went south to Gaza, because it's a coastal city north of Gaza. And so, a lot of times as I'm watching these videos, and you might have heard me say this before, I think about how that could have been me, the girl under the rubble, or the woman that lost her husband or her children and is burying them or amputated. And so, yeah, so it's definitely something that as members of the diaspora, it can hit a lot harder. And it's hard to witness because it's violence. And violence is violence, and it's nasty to witness. But then also there's this double standard that is just so infuriating and frustrating, and it just fills you with rage to see. Even we go back to Sudan, and it's obviously this is, a highlight of the double standards. The RSF, the Rapid Support Forces, are actually determined, like, there was a U.S., I'm forgetting the name of it right now, but they have declared them committing genocide in 2024, right? In the middle of the Israeli genocide of Gaza. And I read that and I'm grateful that they recognize that there is violence there, but it's very equally frustrating to see how they can call it out there, you know, but not here. But then, of course, do we see, have we seen any actual action to stop it? Not necessarily from the U.S., but we have at least seen them call it genocide and call them committing war crimes. But then it, when it's Israel that's committing it, it's like, what happened to everything you just said?
And it's also the same thing with Russia and Ukraine. We also see, you know, what Russia, you know, and I think people also need to realize that, you know, Israel occupies Gaza. They've been occupying Gaza, what, since the 1967?
So they officially occupied Gaza in 1967, and then in the early 2000s, I think 2006, they claim to have unoccupied Gaza, but it's all they did was remove their settlements out of the strip, but they still controlled air, sea, and land. They still did random, what Norman Finkelstein calls mowing the lawn, bombing campaigns. They still murdered lots of Palestinians in Gaza regularly, and so they definitely still fully were occupying it, and now are even more occupying it. And I think just today, an Israeli general was saying that the yellow line is going to be their new border in Gaza. Yes. And so if you're not familiar with the yellow line, basically part of this ceasefire agreement was that Israeli forces would retreat back to a yellow line that roughly cuts Gaza more, about 56%, leaves 56% of Gaza under Israeli military rule, with the rest of it to be negotiated later. Now, if you're Palestinian, you know that those further negotiations never come. But I believe it was today that one of the military leaders of Israel said that that's our new border. And what we've seen, and we see this historically happen, is that they've already encroached on the yellow line itself. They already have military outposts beyond that yellow line, which is what's supposed to be fully Gazan land, which is, you know, all of it, of course, is fully Palestinian Gazan land. But we see this continued encroachment, and we've seen it for a very long time. Yeah, and you know, if you look up the history of what Israel did after it, quote unquote, withdrew from Gaza and no longer occupied it, it's things that make your skin crawl. Like, they controlled the calories that entered Gaza. And basically, there's a quote, and I'm paraphrasing from a leader at that time, basically saying, like, we are going to leave them just hungry enough. And so yeah, absolutely.
I mean, in Gaza, before all this horror and destruction, it was considered one of the most densely populated areas in the whole entire world.
This strip is about 26 miles.
26 miles, and it's a very large number group in a very densely group area.
Yeah, it's considered one of the most densely populated areas in the world, and now even more so densely populated. And now it's going to be
even more, Israel's going to take even more. I just wanted to give kind of an idea to those or listeners who, an idea of the situation and just how horrible and, enraging the whole situation has been. And I know you said 50, in your piece, 56% of the Gaza Strip remains Israeli military control. And of course, there's hundreds and hundreds of, like, checkpoints. Like, obviously, even before all this, Palestinians, they can't travel in Gaza in Gaza freely. It was kind of what you would, it was described as an open air prison.
Yep. And so if you imagine, like, 26 miles by the widest, I think the Gaza Strip is 8 miles. So it's tight space, and Palestinians in Gaza could not leave it. They couldn't leave the strip without Israeli permission, and Israel rarely permitted them to leave that strip.
Yeah.
And now we see that, so not only have they taken the yellow strip, the yellow line, which cuts it into 56%, they've also cut it north and south. They've created basically a military highway that divides Gaza into north and south. And so we've seen this just continuing divisions of what's happening in Gaza. And despite that, you know, it's amazing to also witness what Palestinians in Gaza are still able to do. So recently I saw a clip of how they obviously have a lack of medical equipment, right? Mm-hmm. And they were able to design a new way to hold bones in place, because they don't have access to the traditional kind of equipment. And so, you know, there's a term that Palestinians use called sumud, which means, it translates often into resilience, which is probably the best English translation, but it's just so much more, right? It's living, it's joy, it's resisting, it's existing, and continuing to do so despite all of the violence and the attempts to crush, you know, life out of Palestinians. And I'm sure we will continue to see that. But we really need people to kind of step up now and do more. Unfortunately, since the quote unquote, as if Americans knew, call it not a ceasefire came into place about 56, 57 days ago, there has been a plummet in coverage on Palestine. And it's already been going down. So I recently had an article also, a My Turn article in the News Gazette. And I talk about the massive bias in media coverage. And in that article, you know, I came across some research that's also showing, like, there's an overall decrease in coverage of what's happening in Palestine and Israel. And that in and of itself is problematic because of how intimately related the U.S. and Israel is and the amount of violence that we are literally paying for and complicit in. But then now, since the ceasefire, the not a ceasefire, it's basically disappeared. You know, even though we are still seeing headlines from media that is not biased and that is covering this, we still see articles of, oh, three-year-old girl, this was just yesterday, I believe, three-year-old girl shot dead by Israeli forces. A few days before that, it was an 8 and 11-year-old brothers. And so, you know, making sure that we are personally as involved and able to speak out about it. And so I really appreciate you having me here and talking about all of the things. But a lot of times, you know, this conversation leaves people kind of like, okay, well, what next? And I know before we talked, we mentioned the campaign that CUMAC has going on, the Muslim Action Committee, called the No Appetite for Apartheid in Champaign-Urbana. And basically, this is the next step. This is the next necessary step for ending this violence. And it's an economic pressure campaign. Obviously, the ideal is sanctions and immediate military intervention. Unfortunately, the powers at B are not there yet. I do still believe in continuing to apply pressure on our public officials and doing so in ways that within the resources that we have. So eventually I would love to see things like a general strike in the U.S., like we saw in, you know, in Italy, that forced the Italian government to send ships out with the Freedom Flotillas. That was a few months ago. But until we get there, individual level, the number one most effective thing we can do is join a boycott, divestment, sanctions campaign. So here in Champaign, we have something called No Appetite for Apartheid in CU. Exactly what it sounds like. Basically, it is a boycott focused specifically on food-related products. And so some of the primary targets of the boycott campaign are Israeli exports, and Israeli produce is one of those exports. And the U.S., I believe, is the number one importer of Israeli produce. And so this campaign is saying, hey, we are not going to purchase things. We're not going to eat. We have no appetite for these companies that are participating in, you know, when this campaign was launched, it was in 2022, not locally, but nationally. It's part of a national campaign. When it was not launched nationally, it was 2022. We didn't have this like ongoing genocide that we have now, though there are many that refer to the Nakba and the ongoing Nakba as a genocide, but we didn't have, you know, the Gazan genocide that we have now. So it's no appetite for apartheid, no appetite for genocide, no appetite for occupation, whatever word you'd like to kind of plug in. It's all the same entities that benefit from it and participate in it. And so on a local level, you know, it's boycotting some of the food brands that have supported Israeli soldiers, like Pizza Hut, McDonald's, Papa John's, Burger King, Domino's, and then also Coca-Cola was recently added as a boycott target.
I think Starbucks too, I think.
So Starbucks is a really interesting one. Yeah. Starbucks has been a boycott target for a lot of different campaigns, but especially for like Palestine on and off for years. So much so that in the past they've had to put out statements and things like that. And there is a very grassroots initiative to boycott Starbucks. Right now that is rooted in, especially here in America, it's rooted in the fact that after the whole, you know, genocide in Gaza started, I think a Starbucks union had posted, you know, something in support of Palestinian workers. And in response to that, Starbucks is suing them. And there's this whole, like, background of, like, the whole labor issue that we have with Starbucks and a lot of big businesses in America. And so Starbucks is definitely a grassroots campaign. And I think most people that are part of the Palestine Solidarity Movement are not buying Starbucks. But that said, if you go on like the official BDS movement target, you're not going to find it there because its direct ties to the entity, you know, to the Israeli genocidal entity are not necessarily there. But there is still this massive movement to boycott it on a grassroots level. And so there's a lot of things that if you do a little bit of research into Starbucks, there's a lot of reasons to boycott it, not only for Palestine.
But they don't allow their workers to unionize.
Yep. So the anti-union thing, there's also, I believe at one point I was reading about how some of their plastic cups and stuff are produced through like prison labor here in America, which, you know, is a whole conversation to have. But people boycott Starbucks on and off within a lot of different reasons. So I encourage a boycott of Starbucks, but it's not an official BDS target. And so it's important that if anybody's starting out, they start out with those official targets. And those official targets are 6 food brands. So Coca-Cola, Pizza Hut, Papa John's, Domino's, unfortunately, a lot of the pizza places, but hey, we live in Champaign-Urbana. We have a few cool local brands.
Yeah. Like there's Monocles and other.
Yeah,
and
Monocles, Papa Dell's. Yeah. So we have a few options people can still go for. And then, so the 3 pizzas, Papa John's, Pizza Hut, Domino's, and then there is Burger King and McDonald's, and then there is Coca-Cola. And so Coca-Cola is possibly one of the harder ones, I think, for a lot of people, because once you kind of choose a soda brand, you're kind of, you know, that's your brand. But I know a lot of people have had no problem boycotting it. The other aspect of this campaign is also the apartheid free store network. And that one is where Coca-Cola gets a little trickier, because basically we're going to stores and brands and stores and restaurants and saying, hey, will you join this apartheid free network? Will you say we are taking a moral stance here and we are not going to carry any products that support the genocidal entity? And at the same time, we're going to put a poster up. We're going to let people know, like, this is a public kind of awareness campaign aspect of it. So that's where Coca-Cola gets a little trickier, because there's Coca-Cola. There's its subsidiary brands, too, that are also part of the boycott, like Fairlife Milk. I think Costa Coffee. I think their water brand is Dasani. A few other things. And then there's Israeli produce. Here in Champaign, we have not really been able to find Israeli produce anymore. We were told that it used to be carried. Common Grounds Co-op used to carry some Israeli produce. They do currently carry some Israeli products, or at least one Israeli product that we're,
I think,
you know, hoping.
I think it's wine. It's one. I think one.
You know what? I don't know if we've checked the wines, to be honest. But I believe they carry a tahini brand.
I don't know about Israeli like produce. Dates.
They don't have any dates.
Or hummus.
So typically, historically, yes. But now they don't carry any. We have not been able to find. I'm going to say they don't carry. There have been changes. We did this search. We went through like all the stores.
Is there an app where you can actually check to see if a product is made from?
Yeah. You know. So the official boycott campaign comes from the BDS movement. BDS, it was Boycott, Divestment, Sanctions. There's a committee called the BNC, the BDS National Committee. And they kind of put out a lot of these recommendations. People on a local level can create their own campaigns, but this is like these are the priority targets, or these are the grassroots targets. And they have partnered with one of these apps that you mentioned called Boycat. So instead of boycott, Boycat. And it basically allows you to look up items. I don't know if it allows you to scan, but it allows you to look up all these items and then get different varying levels of complicity. Because items are not only, because when you look at like who can benefit from this genocide and this occupation, it's so multi-layered. There are the companies that are directly complicit with, for example, obviously like weapons manufacturers and transporters that carry the weapons there. There are companies that have factories in the West Bank and illegal settlements. There are companies that are, you know, taking resources out of the West Bank, for example. And then there are companies that benefit from the lands of 1948, which is what Palestinians refer to, which is currently what most people refer to as Israel. But for Palestinians, these are the lands that were stolen and occupied in 1948. And so there's varying levels of complicity. And then there's companies that might have 1 degree removed or 2 degrees removed. So this app is really nice because it tells you what the priority targets are. And then it tells you even further than that if you want to go further than that. But I just want to make sure that people are focused on those priority targets. Because a boycott is successful when it's collective. On an individual level, I know so many people, especially within the movement, that like, I don't want a dollar of mine to go to support this, right? Mm. And I am so appreciative of all these people that are so cautious about where they put their money. But when we're talking about a grand scale and we're talking about talking to so many people, we want to make sure it's like that targeted boycott. Mm. You know what I mean? Yeah.
I know in Illinois was actually, there is what you would call anti-BDS law. And in fact, Illinois was the first state in the country to pass. That was under Bruce Rauner, but it got bipartisan support. Penalizes companies that boycott Israel. This was in 2015, the anti-boycott pension investment. I know that's something that's been brought up a lot in Champaign City Council, some of the Champaign City Council meetings. I believe 30 companies are currently on the Illinois investment policy boards that are prohibited. This is prohibiting companies for boycotting Israel, companies like Ben & Jerry's Ice, which you would think that would be a violation of First Amendment, but for some reason, no, they are penalized. And and actually, I will say, not that people weren't ever punished or penalized for criticizing Israel in any way. You know, usually you would see like a lot of college professors fired for that, and we certainly have seen that since Gaza, in fact. But now we've seen the Trump administration actually gone after Northwestern University and I think Columbia University, which I know has been kind of a main center point of all of, student protests. Obviously, we had students protesting here. Somebody for Students for Justice in Palestine.
Yeah. There's a whole legal mess. You brought up, you know, in Illinois, I think it was in 2015, the anti-BDS bill passed. And, you know, it's very problematic as a bill in and of itself initially, but its application is actually very narrow in the sense that it only applies, which is a big amount of money, but it only applies to pension funds. It doesn't apply to any other fund, but it created the desired chilling effect. So when we were working in Champaign City Council trying to get them to push divestment, they actually brought up this bill. And it's like, well, it doesn't apply here. This is not a pension fund. We're not talking specifically about pensions. It should not apply. It does not apply. But unfortunately, it created this chilling effect. But there is a bill right now that was currently introduced by Representative Rashid, Abdel Nasser Rashid, it's called the Illinois Human Rights Advocacy Protection Act. And it's in the House and it's in the Senate right now.
Yeah, House Bill 2723. Yeah. I believe there's also a Senate bill by Mike Porfirio.
I believe so, yes.
Senate Bill 2462. Those were introduced earlier this year. I believe they're still kind of stalled at the moment.
So they're currently, I think they haven't been put up for a vote yet, but basically it's a bill to repeal this act, and it was launched in February. The House bill was launched in February, and then a few weeks later, the Senate bill. And right now, amongst other people, are pushing for people to publicly support these bills. So if you're also looking for something else to do and get involved, this is definitely one way, as people that live in Illinois, that we can push forward a campaign to remove what is essentially a racist bill in the first place, you know, to say that private institutions, to say that people can't choose to boycott. And if they choose to boycott, there'll be repercussions for them. It's something that's very problematic. And that's why I really like the name of the new bill, which is a Human Rights Advocacy Protection Act, right? It is fully within our right to buy from whoever we want and to choose not to buy from whoever we want. But this bill makes it so that even private companies are now checking with lawyers before seeing if they can boycott a company or not because of this existence of this bill. So the chilling effect it's had is really problematic. You know, it follows a trend of the 2015 law follows a trend of legislation and policies that chill pro-human rights advocacy. And we've seen the effects of those locally here, right? We've seen the charges against our students and community members on campus.
I believe they were trying to put federal charge. I think she was, but I think not guilty of federal.
So those that were tried from 2024, I don't know if there's anything new or not, but those, yeah, so they were all basically, the felonies were basically dropped, and they ended up just being charged for the misdemeanors was what kind of stuck. But yes, essentially they were charged with felonies for putting up tents against a genocide, right? And so there's this massive desire amongst the law to our legal enforcement and people like administrations of a university, for example, to silence this movement. But we cannot unsee what we've seen. We're not going to unsee it. Everybody that has witnessed what they've witnessed is not going to go back to, oh yeah, life is normal. And so that's one of the things that I am most, you know, holding on to in terms of hope, moving forward, is that there's no one seeing this. There's no undoing the damage that has been done to Israel's image worldwide.
Yeah. And then, you know, we have seen, especially people who are obviously not U.S. citizens, was it Mahmoud Khalil, who was arrested. Thankfully, he was, has been released. I know he's, I'm not sure if he's still dealing, I'm sure he's still probably.
I think his case is pending, but I'm not sure.
Yeah, depending on the judge. I know there was a student who wrote an article, and she was charged with, she was from Turkey, but I believe she has been released. But you have seen a targeting of people who have, especially for people who aren't U.S., national born citizens, you know, using ICE as an instrument to go after, created this very authoritarian, fascist, whatever you want to call it.
Yeah, and one of the examples of these is Sami Hamdi. I'm not sure if you've heard of his story, but Sami Hamdi is a British citizen who is like a political analyst, and he was on a visit to the U.S., and he was visiting different mosques and speaking about kind of what's going on. He's been very vocal, very anti-Israeli, very pro-Palestinian, pro-human rights, pro-life. And he actually had his visa revoked mid-visit, and he had ICE agents pull up on him at an airport, and they said, your visa's revoked, now you are here illegally, right? And this was the first time that he was notified of this, while he was actively already in the U.S., had been in the U.S. for some time. And he was in an airport. He's like, okay, I'm going to book a flight. I'll leave right now. And they're like, no, you have to be detained. And they detained him for about 3 weeks. And so every instance of ICE detainment and everything that we read about it is incredibly horrifying to see this escalation of a lack of consideration for U.S. law. You know, the way they're operating, the way they're not identified and they're masked. And I think from, you just hear so many stories of people literally being kidnapped, pulled off the streets. And yeah, it all goes hand in hand. There's like this like complete disregard for human rights locally, internationally. Yeah. And, you know, I hope that we can bind together moving forward. But it's something that, unfortunately, is just really unfortunate, you know, to kind of be witnessing and seeing happen before our eyes.
Yeah. I will say, I don't know if you knew about this, but the city of St. Louis actually voted to not do business with any country or company that violates human rights. I believe it was 11-1. This was in the past, I think, month. And it's the biggest city from there. And as somebody who grew up there, I was very proud of it. I know that's also where Cori Bush, who wrote the ceasefire resolution, unfortunately, she lost her race, but I believe she is going to run again in the upcoming 2024 midterms, who I've also interviewed a couple of members of Congress, 13th Congressional District, I believe the primary here in Illinois. So that is one thing people can do. They can look at where candidates stand on Israel. Obviously, right now, the Democratic Party base, and even especially young voters, they support both, obviously, they support Palestine, and they support arms embargo against Israel. So I believe this is the most support for Palestine that we've seen, especially in my life. Mm-hmm. I know that for sure.
You're right. Yeah. It is definitely the highest level of support Palestine has seen in the U.S., and that is definitely very profound, and it's a very important moment and movement moving forward.
Well, thank you so much for coming on. I don't know if there's anything else you would let our viewers know.
Just if people want to follow kind of my work or our work at the CU Muslim Action Committee, you can find us on Instagram at CU Muslim, MUSLIM, action.com. You can also visit our website, cumuslimaction.com. I'm sorry, Instagram is not .com. Wow, it was going too fast. cumuslimaction on Instagram. You can follow our website. We're also on Instagram. We're also on Facebook, Champaign Urbana Muslim Action Committee. So to, you know, hear from you and see you connect. And if you're interested in being a part of this boycott campaign, you can also pledge on our website.
Well, thank you so much again, Dua. And please feel free. You're welcome to come back on anytime here at WEFT.
Thank you so much for having me.
That was Dua Al-Dasuki. She also had a couple of articles in the News Gazette, not just as well as the Public Eye, but also in the News Gazette, which she mentioned one of them, which one was titled "Where's the Palestinian side of the story in media's coverage?" That was published in the News Gazette on November 25th. And another one called "Life Under Quote Ceasefire," that was published in the News Gazette on October 28th that you can read. Again, thanks to Dua Aldasuki for coming on, and she's more than welcome to come back anytime. Let's see. I'm going to I've got a little bit of time left, so I think I'm just going to jump and play a little bit of Breakthrough News, which is a pre-recorded program. So I'll just go into that, play that for you now for the next remaining time.
Breakthrough. Welcome to Breakthrough Radio, the best of breakthrough news brought to you for 1 hour each week. I'm Sean Blackman. Now to our first story.
The Trump White House engages in straight-out piracy by seizing a Venezuelan oil tanker on its way to Cuba. Donald Trump says he's giving the economy an A++++ grade under his administration. Millions of people are about to lose health care, and Trump's approval rating is headed towards the basement. I'm Leanne Sima-Fullahan, and this is In the News, a segment of the Socialist Program.
Leanne, we have a lot to talk about again, as we always do. There's this seizure of Venezuela's assets, this time an oil tanker. Back in 2019, the United States and Britain seized $1 billion worth of Venezuela's gold. They stole the Venezuelan embassy in Georgetown in Washington, D.C. They just stole so many Venezuelan assets. But now you have the USS Gerald Ford, the aircraft carrier, a destroyer group, many U.S. fighter jets in the vicinity of Venezuela. They're not only bombing boats, destroying boats, killing fishermen, now seizing a Venezuelan oil tanker on its way to Cuba. And of course, Cuba desperately needs oil. There's many blackouts going on in Cuba. Anyway, all-out war against Venezuela. We're going to talk more about that. We've been talking about it all week. We had mass demonstrations in 65 cities a week ago. Manolo de los Santos and I did a special webinar on Wednesday night. A lot to talk about there. We're also going to talk about how the economy is tanking for the working class. We're going to talk about the billionaires. There is the Trump billionaires. There's some major media stories about how the billionaires are dominating the Trump White House. That's not exactly new news, but it's kind of interesting to talk about it. How the anti-immigrant position of the Trump administration, the xenophobia of Trump and Stephen Miller and the team, are hitting all-time new highs. And we're going to talk about that. But before we start with our news stories, I want to share an anecdote with our audience. I traveled yesterday on Thursday from New York City to Washington, D.C. I arrived around 5:15 in the afternoon at Union Station, the Amtrak terminal in Washington, D.C., about 3 blocks from the Capitol building. And as I was on my way to the subway, to the metro, as it's called in the Washington, D.C. system, I heard this big commotion. And so, of course, I went to find out what was going on. I heard people yelling. And so I went to the other side of the terminal, and there were these three high school girls. They might have been 14 years old, maybe 15 years old. Union Station in Washington is sort of a center. It's sort of like right in the center of the city. So a lot of kids coming to and from school, they pass through Union Station. Undoubtedly, kids get off. There's, you know, shopping opportunities. People hang out there a little bit. Anyway, they were being confronted by several older white Amtrak police officers who were telling them, "You must leave. You must leave." And they were like, "We don't have to leave. We can stay here." And then the cops started chasing them because they didn't want to leave. And they went all around. I followed the whole scene as it evolved. And eventually, a huge number of cops were surrounding this one girl, this one 14-year-old. And also on the scene was a fairly large detachment of National Guard, deployed National Guard forces in uniform, who, as the police were handcuffing this girl, established in front of them and behind them a sort of military formation, you know, two parallel columns of soldiers in uniform, led by somebody at the top of each column. It was really something. There was probably 25 or 30 people, meaning police and National Guard, involved in securing the arrest of this one 15-year-old girl who was not violent. There was nothing big going on. She just didn't want to leave Union Station when the Amtrak police were telling her that she had to get out of there. And I was thinking, like, this is what Donald Trump is sort of crowing about as keeping America safe, the deployment of National Guard to the nation's capital. And you're thinking about, not only do the National Guard's people not want to be there, and of course we have the terrible shooting of National Guard's people a couple of weeks ago, not only do they not want to be there, not only do they absolutely want to be back on their jobs and with their families, but what a waste of resources. All of it to create or to maintain, to sustain this fiction by Donald Trump that deploying military forces to urban areas is critically important to the safety and security of the people of the United States, and that Trump is making America not just great again, but safe again. Anyway, really something.
Really crazy story, Brian. I'm glad you shared it. I mean, I can't believe that all this money is being spent and so many people are being deployed. The military is being deployed into the streets to so-called keep Americans safe, when in fact, what they're doing is threatening people. I mean, surrounding a 14-year-old girl with dozens of police officers and National Guard members doesn't sound like they're keeping her safe.
Yeah. And, you know, when you think about the expenditure, the resources, the National Defense so-called Authorization Act was, I think, just passed either by the House or the Senate. But, you know, let's just talk a little bit about what's in this bill.
Well, it was just passed by the House. It's set to go forward to the Senate. There's been quite a bit of news about it, quite a bit of media that's been touting it as this major attack on the Trump administration because it's going to force Pete Hegseth to release unedited videos of the boat strikes on September 2nd, which have been the subject of major discussions inside Congress. They want to see if he did a second strike. It also says that it will put limits on Trump's ability to reduce the number of troops in Europe. So this is supposed to be like a jab at Trump. But if you actually look at the bill, Brian, first of all, it's a 3,086-page bill. There's a lot in this bill. And it's set to approve a $900 billion budget for what they're calling the Department of Defense, but what Pete Hegseth has more aptly renamed the Department of War. What's actually in this bill, besides some of the kind of sensationalist politicking that has surrounded it? Well, basically, lots of gifts to the U.S. weapons industry. I want to actually just go through some of the inclusions. There's so much that is included in the $900 billion. It's hard to wrap our minds around how much money $900 billion actually is. But let's see where that money is actually going. Okay, well, one of the inclusions is $400 million for Ukraine security assistance. What does that mean? Is that they're giving $400 million to Ukraine? No, that means they're giving $400 million to spend on U.S. weapons and security agencies and companies to do this so-called security assistance and prolong the war in Ukraine. Then it says it extends the Pacific Deterrent Initiative to improve U.S. posture in the Indo-Pacific region. What does that mean? It means funding increases for new technologies needed to deter China, such as hypersonic missiles, artificial intelligence, cyber mobile micronuclear reactors, and high energy lasers. That's over $2.7 billion. And what they're calling this essential military construction projects in that region with all those things I just listed, hypersonic missiles and high energy lasers.
Well, let's just, you know, emphasize that other point. This money is not going to Ukraine. It's really not going to the Pacific. It's really just going to American capitalist corporations.
Yes. I mean, who's making the hypersonic missiles? Who's making the AI, the autonomous systems, the mobile micronuclear reactors? What are these things? Why are they needed? Do we really need to be deterring China in China's own region with all of this technology? Well, the capitalist corporations certainly do, because they're going to make quite a lot of money with this, basically this gift from the U.S. White House. They're giving them $2.7 billion to develop just for this technology in the Indo-Pacific region.
Yeah. At the same time, the U.S. government, just the Congress, the Senate, and the House just decided not to extend the subsidies for the 22 million people, low income and working class people, on the Affordable Care Act, so-called Obamacare subsidies, so that their premiums don't go through the roof. You know, I want to talk about that. Trump has been talking about it. All this money for the Pentagon, $900 billion, which is really, it's really not the number. That's the Department of War. But when you look at the Department of Energy and other U.S. executive agencies, the real number for so-called defense spending or war spending is about $1.5 trillion. And remember, a billion is 1,000 millions. A trillion is 1,000 billions. There's more than $1.5 trillion every year spent on basically the Pentagon. And they always say it's for national security. It's to keep us safe, Leanne. But the last time the U.S. was invaded was the War of 1812, kind of an easy war to remember, the War of 1812. That would have been 213 years ago. The U.S. is surrounded by a big ocean on the west, that's the Pacific, a big ocean on the east, the Atlantic. No country is threatening to invade the United States. And yet the United States spends $1.5 trillion a year for armaments and for getting ready for the next war. And meanwhile, the government says, oh, we're just not going to pay any more money for subsidies so that people can continue to access health care. Now, the whole Affordable Care Act was, in a way, and I want to discuss it, it was a gift to health insurance capitalists who actually provide no medical services. Obamacare, as it's called, was a requirement that in order to access health care, you had to sign up with a private capitalist health insurance company. But the deal was that if you couldn't afford it, that the government would subsidize you. And so a lot of people have been able to access healthcare for the first time because of these subsidies. Again, the subsidies are for the insurance companies, basically. So Trump is demagogically saying, well, I don't want to give the money to...
I'm going to end that program. The views and opinions expressed on air are solely those of the speaker. I do not necessarily represent those of WFT Champaign, Prairie Air Incorporated, Station Management, the Board of Directors, or the WFT Associates. Now that wraps up here where we're at here on WFT Champaign, 90.1 FM. Of course, stream us online at weft.org. There will not have a show next week. We will be playing our yearly holiday Christmas Carol program. But happy holidays from us here at WFT 90.1 FM radio. But please keep listening to us here on WEFT 90.1 FM radio. Have a good night.